Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 3 of Sharp and Hot with me, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Episode 3! Episode 1, I will tell you, was very nervous-making. Those of you who said it was really good, I totally appreciate your support, even though I think you might have been lying a little bit. But last week, I feel like we really got going, and I think we're definitely onto something. And so, third time's a charm. I'm not nervous anymore. And your cooking questions keep rolling in via the power of the internet on Twitter, at Chef Emily P, on Facebook, /sharpandhot, and best of all, by phone, 862-242-8599. On this week's episode, we're going to talk about my treatise on hot peppers and what I know about them. Your questions about some Instagram woes and potluck weddings and the question of last week, and I will pose to you the question for next week. So I've taught a lot of people a lot of things. I've been teaching cooking since 2009, and I taught math in middle school before that, and I taught second grade before that. So I know how to be a teacher. I mean, I've been teaching a long time, and I think that I know how to be a good teacher. And one of the ways I think the teachers become good teachers is by challenging the assumptions, both their own assumptions about stuff and the assumptions that the people that they are teaching are bringing to the table, whether they're 50 or 5. When you're teaching in a classroom, you've got a whole year or a whole semester to unpack the beliefs that your students have, like math is stupid or God is real or Pokemon is better than SpongeBob or whatever. And my goal has always been, in the year-long scenario, to lay out some much less dogmatic and idealistic ideologies and just offer people some cud to chew on and think over the things that they hold so dear, perhaps by giving them some safety and some freedom to think quietly to themselves without anybody judging them out loud or telling them that they're wrong. They'll think, well, maybe I could see where there's a place for math in the world, or, but that something would, that they would start thinking in a way that if I wasn't breathing down their neck saying, of course there's a place for math. How do you think we build bridges? How do you think we build buildings? And if I just said, well, maybe you could imagine a way in which math is important, then I would go from having a kid that hates math to a kid who's a regular at the Math is Fun folder by June. In the world of cooking classes, at least in the world that I'm in, I only see the people that I'm teaching who are primarily adults for 3 or 4 hours, and then they go home. And so by and large, they ask me questions, and I give them answers. Like, is it true that I shouldn't order fish on Mondays? Or is it true that I should eat oysters outside of months that have the letter R in them? In both cases, just side note, in both cases, the answer is no. Both of these things refer to sort of a bygone era of touchy refrigeration in the case of oysters, and 7-day-a-week delivery in the case of fish, and also probably pre-health inspectors. But in both cases, you're fine to eat fish and oysters whenever you want to. And part of why I have you guys ask me questions in advance, and I record them or I have them loaded in the Facebook feed, as opposed to taking questions live on the air, so that I can make sure that I've had the time to give you the best possible information. Because I think that that's one of the things that makes somebody a good teacher. Give me the time to make sure that I'm giving you the right information, because as it turns out, I don't know everything. I think that I do, but in fact, I don't know everything. Like, for example, does alcohol burn off when you cook it? This is one that I've got to actually look into because I don't really know. I know everyone says, yeah, totally. Everyone, it's just a given. You pour in the alcohol and then you cook it and the alcohol cooks off. But I've actually heard that that's not the case. And if alcohol was so transient, then why was I ID'd on my middle school trip to Washington, D.C. at the Godiva chocolate store when I asked for a Kahlua truffle? Not that I knew anything about what Kahlua was in eighth grade, but I knew that my aunts liked it, so I ordered one, and they said no. So I got to look into the alcohol one. I think I got to find a food scientist and get them on the phone to explain it to me, because I'm not entirely sure. But there's one that I get asked a lot, which is about hot peppers. And I know the answer. Is it true that removing the seeds and the white veins of hot peppers makes them less hot? Absolutely not. No way. No how. A hot pepper is a hot pepper, and nothing but nothing that you can do is going to make them less hot. If habaneros or like ghost peppers could be made less hot so easily by something so simple, then everyone would just take the seeds out and not make such a BFD about how hot their salsas are, how hot their curries are, because a hot pepper's hot. Like, that's why they're called hot peppers, right? I don't know. That question has been gnawing at me because I get asked it so much that there's got to be some proof out there, but I've been walking around like an authority, so I decided that I was going to do some research. And the first place that I could go is Google, but since the internet lies so much, I decided that I was going to make my own proof. And starting back in February, with this in mind, I was looking through my heirloom seed catalogs, and I designated a bed in my garden for growing the hot peppers. So I was a little bit obsessed. This goes back 6 months, maybe even more than that. So I picked out a variety of heirlooms. I planted fish peppers and Santa Fe Grands and Black Hungarians, and all of those are known for being hot. And then 6 months later, I planned my husband's birthday party, which was 2 weekends ago, knowing that my peppers would be ripe at the time and that we'd be having people over because, well, I needed people to taste test. So the last weekend in August rolls around, and 30 or so of our friends who were totally amped to eat smoked pig head, which is what was on the menu, were on their way over, and I had a captive audience for the salsa tasting. My grand experiment to show how dumb every food blogger out there is and how I know that hot peppers are hot. So I knew that I had controlled for every variable because I grew the peppers from seed. They were coming off plants that I had started in my basement under my grow lights, and I was also using tomatoes and cilantro that I had grown. So the only variable, the only thing that I bought was an onion, and I split that in half. So here's what I did. Into the Vitamix went all the tomatoes and the onion and all the cilantro and some salt. And I pureed that into the base of the salsa. And then I split each pepper that I grew in half. And I put the two halves into two piles. So half of the one pepper went into one pile, half went into the other pile. And when I had all the peppers split, I took the seeds and the white part out from one of the piles. And then the other pile I left intact. So every pepper, not only had I grown all the peppers, but every pepper was in every batch, or in both batches, I should say, both comparison batches. Then I took my salsa base and I divided that in half into two bowls. And then I put one bowl of salsa puree back into the Vitamix with my peppers with the seeds and the white part, and I pureed that and poured that into bowl number one. And then the others, I pureed the peppers. I used the other half of the salsa and I pureed the peppers that I had taken the white part out. And I had labeled the two bowls, number one and number two. And I was standing in my kitchen and I was going to taste it before anyone got there. My husband was standing there and he had a spoon in his hand too. And there was this moment of apprehension because I've been telling this authoritative story for years that a hot pepper is hot and there's nothing but nothing that you're going to do to unhot it. And I did. I had like my lines down. Like, this is one of my go-to jokes and I know how to make it funny. And I knew that standing there in my kitchen with a spoon in my hand, it was either going to be totally the same, which is obvious. It was going to be totally the same, or it was going to be dramatically different. But since I knew it was going to be totally the same, I wasn't worried because it was just so obvious to me. So into my mouth, the spoon went, and I was totally wrong. I was totally wrong. Bowl number one, the bowl with just the pepper flesh, was so sweet. It was not hot at all. Bowl number two was so spicy. It was nearly inedible, and my mouth burned for an hour. And I couldn't believe it. I still can't entirely believe it. Not that I was wrong, but that, oh yeah, I mean that I was like so wrong. And well, I still set the bowls out at the party because that's what I said I was going to do. And just in case there was something wrong with my taste buds or my husband's taste buds, yep, totally unanimous. It was obvious I was wrong. And now I have my captive audience of 30 who are not only there to eat and drink, but to look at me and say, nice try, dummy. So I guess, I guess I have to make sure that I record your questions in advance because, again, that's how I know that I'm doing my job right, is to give you the best information possible. And I think it's important as a teacher to, like, test some of your own assumptions and, like, do some research and don't just Google it and don't just walk around telling everybody, like, you know, because not always, you don't always know. Your questions after this.
You're listening to Carolina Peach by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Stay tuned for more Sharp and Hot.
I've been living in California, and everything's just fine. But I get a funny, funny feeling each year about the same time. It's when the nights get warm and there's something sweet that I crave. Nothing they got out here I really tastes the same. I'm talking about a sweet, 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 sweet Carolina peach. I want my Carolina peach. I got oranges all winter. I got avocados in the spring. Blueberries in July to make my taste.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
I guess I have to reevaluate that whole SpongeBob versus Pokemon thing, too. Also, I love that Carolina Peaches song, or the California Honey Drops, whatever that is. It's just so cute. Okay, so now your questions. Let's start with this one.
Hi, Chef Emily. This is Allison from Burlington, Vermont. I just had a question for you. I recently went on a date with someone who I like, but spent the whole meal picture taking and posting to Instagram snapshots of our meal. That was weird. How can I ask him politely not to do that? Thanks so much.
This is really a timely question. If you've never been at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, I have a view. I have a giant window cut into the container ship that the radio station's built into, and there's a lot of people eating lunch that I am looking out on, and occasionally they are looking in on me. And at some point, I just looked over, and everyone had their camera out and was taking pictures of what was put down in front of them. So yeah, it's a problem. I don't know. It's not a problem. It's a real reality that we have social media in our lives, right? So my question is about this person that you're out on a date with, is what makes them so interesting that you said you like them? So I'm curious what it is that makes them so interesting. Because to me, basic, like, good behavior and grace, I think that's really interesting. And it's way more interesting than what sort of passes on the first or second date for interesting, which is like, well, he's hot. And I've been there. Like, I was single once. Or he's rich. And I've been there too. And that also wears off. So if this is someone that passes those two tests and is someone that you plan on spending more time with and you like to eat and you both like to eat, then I assume that you're going to be out in a lot of restaurants. And so now, early on, is the time to either nip this in the bud if it really bothers you. And you can do it nicely and say something like, hey, so, I should say, don't do it while it's happening. Do it like in calm waters over a cup of coffee or, you know, whatever at some other point, but not while the photographing is actually happening. But you say something like, so I don't know, I have a feeling, I kind of think like maybe when it's just the two of us out to dinner, maybe it's not the best time to be engaging with the rest of the world. But like, seriously, he's not in touch with the entire rest of the world, even though social media, which is part of the problem, makes us feel that way. In fact, I mean, unless he's Anthony Bourdain, which he's not, because Anthony Bourdain's married, right? So let's say he's got a lot. Let's say generously he's got a lot of Instagram followers. So like, let's say 1,000. And you don't want to hurt anybody's ego because that's really hard to come back from. But something to the effect of, like, those 25 people who know you and the 975 strangers who don't aren't out to dinner with you. Like, I am. And his reaction to that is going to tell you everything that you need to know. If he reacts like a gracious human being and is kind of embarrassed or is like, oh my God, you're so right. That's totally douchey. And I didn't even realize. Oh, I'm so sorry. And you have to also be sure that you're not doing the same thing. But whatever. If he's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, then boom, you're in the clear. Didn't realize he was doing something obnoxious. If it happens again, then you're like, hey, remember how we talked about that's kind of jerky and obnoxious and you're ignoring me? Any other reaction? One of like righteousness or condescension or flat out ignoring you and be like, yeah, yeah, hang on one second. I just have to post it. Hang on one second. Just dump him. Like, it's a window into a personality type of somebody that I wouldn't want to spend any more time with, but that's just me. But what I would do in that case, split the tab, say, hey, you know what? This has been real. And I would move on to someone that my granny's going to say, oh, he's so sweet. And if that guy reacts any other way than totally apologetic, then he ain't that guy that granny's going to like.
Hey, Chef Emily. This is Sarah calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. And I'm getting married on a really tight budget, and all my guests and family members really are into food, so I was thinking of making up at a potluck wedding because I think they'd enjoy cooking and contributing, but I also don't want to inconvenience them, and then I don't know what people are going to bring. So I was just wondering what your opinion was. Good idea to do a potluck wedding or bad idea?
So I love the idea of potluck weddings in theory. I mean, particularly because I have a lot of friends who love to cook and love to eat and are really good cooks. I also have some friends who love to cook that aren't that great. No, I'm just kidding. They're probably listening. Everyone who I am friends with is an excellent cook. But here's the thing. When you do a potluck anything, it's going to take a lot of coordination. Even though you're like delegating everything, it seems like, well, I've delegated everything. Like, how much work could there possibly be for me? In fact, you're going to be fielding phone calls like, so-and-so is gluten-free, so I can't really make that cake. Or, you know, my guest is a freegan, so what I make, like my pie is going to like kind of depend on what Whole Foods is throwing away that night. So I don't really know. Or like, I don't really want to cook the quiche she assigned me. How about I make my like famous oatmeal instead? And in your head, you're going to be like, oatmeal? Who the hell makes oatmeal for a wedding? But your Aunt Sarah is totally serious. And you're going to not want to hurt her feelings. And you're going to have 10 other things that you're trying to like juggle at the time. And so you're going to end up with cold martini glasses filled with oatmeal. Which, you know, no one's going to remember anyway. I bet if you surveyed the people that were at my wedding, they couldn't tell you what we had. But I don't know. I also wouldn't serve cold oatmeal personally. So even though you might save some on the financial end, I'd seriously consider appointing like someone who's really organized, like your cousin or your friend, like the chief culinary officer, so that the delegation of who brings what and how many people they have to feed, because one of the questions that you always get is, how many people are you serving? So if I am in charge of making pasta salad, am I making pasta salad for everybody? So if I'm making pasta salad for 100 people and I am not, you know, a trained chef and I'm not a caterer, that's a lot of pasta salad to ask one person to make. So then are they only making pasta salad for 10 or 20? So you put somebody in charge and then they'll tell everybody how much to bring and who's got cups and who's bringing plates and who's bringing the bar. And that responsibility won't fall to you, the bride. My only bride meltdown was being asked one too many times about hotels. And I got married in my hometown. And so having grown up there, I never stayed in a hotel. Yet I was asked over and over and over again to be the trip advisor for the out-of-town grown-ups. And this was in the age of the internet. And these were grown-ups. These weren't my 22-year-old cousins coming from wherever. And I found myself literally doing hotel research on my hometown.
and it was not awesome. And it was one of my very few sort of hissy fits that I threw. So I guess the caveat is if you're a professional caterer getting married and you can say, you make this, do this, and this, and done, then go for it if you fully trust that the people that you're talking to are able to execute your plan. As a professional caterer, generally speaking, I still need to be in the room with other trained chefs to make sure that I execute my plan. So option B, appoint a trusted and highly organized friend or cousin to be your chief culinary officer, which I think I'm going to have business cards made because that title sounds kind of awesome. Or do something like make your own cake, buy a dress on consignment, and save some money somewhere else and hire a caterer. Because if your guests are hungry, because all they got is cold oatmeal and freaking pie, then they're going to be not having a good time at your wedding. And the whole point of having a wedding is to give people a good time, right? Because it's like one big party to celebrate how awesome you and your fiance are. So you've got questions. I've got answers. As we talked about in the first half of the show, I'm going to make sure that the answers that I give you are the right answers. The best way to get yourself heard on the air is to call the dedicated voicemail line. The number is 862-242-8599 and leave your question there. And I will take some time and come up with a thoughtful response. You can also tweet me at sharpenhot or facebook.com/sharpenhot. And let's see, last week... Oh, if you tweet me or Facebook me, I'm probably going to ask you to call the line anyway. But if you're shy and you need a little bit more encouragement, then I will message you directly and then you can feel like you're personally connected to me. And I'm going to say, hey, that's a great question, but could you record it? Because it sounds way more fun when it's your own voice. So that being said, I'm going to break my rule in just a second here. But last week, I posed the question of the week to you, which was, what was the best meal you've ever had? And let's see. I'm going to play one from Brad, I'm going to read you one from Facebook, which is the rule that I'm about to break, and then I'll tell you mine. Let's see.
Hi, Emily. This is Brad from New York. The best meal I ever had, tragically, I don't know what it was called. I used to work at an overnight place, a restaurant that was open all night long, and the Jamaican chef that worked there would make me and my coworker a meal at 3 o'clock in the morning that was sausage and chicken and shrimp all thrown together with a ribbon pasta in this spicy Cajun cream sauce that was amazing and so buttery and fantastic. So I don't even know if this thing had a name. It was off the menu. So I actually don't know what the best meal I ever had was called. Maybe you do. Thank you. Bye.
I don't. But I wish that I did because that sounds awesome. I get asked a lot what my favorite thing to cook is, and I always say it's Cajun and Creole food. It sounds to me like a base of jambalaya. Like they were probably following a jambalaya recipe, but they had some ribbon pasta left over, and they threw some cream and butter in because that just makes everything delicious too. That would be my guess, but I don't know. I can't tell you. I will try it, though I'll try to make some. Okay, now I'm going to pull up something that Katie left on our Facebook feed. Let's see. Best meal ever. Okay, so Katie wrote this on Sharpenhot, facebook.com/sharpenhot, and I have to read this out loud because I read it in my head. I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. Best meal ever was spicy boar collar medallions at the Pock Pock in Portland before it came to New York, where it was served with a side of mustard greens, under crushed ice and rice to quell the heat. It was the first time I understood spicy as a flavor rather than just a burn. That sounds amazing. I have to look up Pock Pock. I also have to go to Portland. I have friends who just visited Portland and ate their way across the city and said it was amazing. The best meal I've ever had, there was a bunch. I went to Jose Andreas's restaurant that he opened in the space at Mini Bars in several summers ago now. It was part of the exhibit with the National Archives where they served a menu. It's called America Eats, and they served a menu of classic American foods. So like the hot dog or buffalo wings or key lime pie. And it was unlike any, you know, it sounds pretty straightforward. It was unlike anything I'd ever had. I had abalone for the first time and it was unreal. But, kind of along the lines of Brad's story on the theme of longing, this is, I think, the real I think it's a more romantic best meal ever story. There used to be a bar in Park Slope that I worked in like 2001, 2002 called the Blah Blah Lounge. And it was at the end of the smoking era, or, you know, right when the smoking ban was going into place, there was a very brief period of time where you couldn't, I forget exactly how it was, but you couldn't eat and smoke in the same place. Like, you couldn't smoke in restaurants, but you could smoke in bars. And the Blah Blah Lounge was technically a bar, but they also served food. So for this brief moment of time when you couldn't smoke anywhere else, you could eat and smoke in the same place. And that drew me to the Blah Blah Lounge often. And they had a burger on the menu there, and it was so good. And I've cooked a lot of burgers in my time since then, and I've basically given up on trying to recreate it. But it was like the perfect ratio of meat to bun, and it was seasoned with some, I can't remember it clearly enough to try to recreate it. It was just that it was so good. And it could also have been a particular part of my life that I was feeling, you know, young and beautiful and hip and living in my, on my own in Brooklyn. And so that probably contributed to how delicious the burger was. Remember before I said there were people who were taking pictures? Somebody just took my picture through the window. I bet they're Instagramming that right now. so anyway, I don't know where that burger went in my life. It's also a tragedy. And I recently, well, within the last 5 years, I was in touch with the owner and I asked him about it. And he remembers that that burger was good, but he has no idea what I was talking about. So Brad, I feel your pain. Okay, so let's see. This week's question is, I want to hear, what is your earliest food memory or memories? You can send more than one. Or childhood, sort of influential childhood food memories. I'm very excited that next week I have my first guest who's coming on, author Davey Rothbart, who wrote a memoir, or I guess a collection of stories called My Heart is an Idiot, which I highly recommend. It's very funny and very heartwarming. And he's also the creator of Found Magazine, which is published based on, the content is all stuff that people have found on the street and sent to him. So receipts and love letters and weird things. My husband once found somebody's ATM receipts still stuck in the machine when he went to get money out, and their checking account balance was like $350,000. That's the kind of thing that I would send to Found Magazine if I'd known about it then, because I really want to know what that feels like. But so anyway, Davey's going to be here to help me answer some of your food questions, and he's going to talk to me about his food memories. And he's not like a food person, so it's going to be interesting and fun. And I think it's fun to get not food people to talk about food stuff and give you some advice, and I'll tell you if it's good advice or not good advice. And so if you have food questions for Davey or food questions for me, phone number here is 862-242-8599. Leave a message on the voicemail. You can tweet me at Chef Emily P. And you can find out more information on www.sharpandhot.com. I want to thank Joe for engineering the show. I totally forgot to thank him last week. He's my engineer, and he's awesome. And more information on Heritage Radio Network can be found on heritageradionetwork.org. And I'm looking forward to next week. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.